as the presidents of the St. Mary's Law Students here, the second shift of Professor Johnson's class, we welcome you to our court. Call the third case.
May the police report, Mr. Evans will present evidence, will present argument for the petition.
May the police report, I'm David Evans, and together with Chris Grissell, I represent Mike Schultz here today. And as a preliminary matter, I anticipate one of your first concerns on a mandamus proceeding is whether there's a change in the status of the parties. There is not any that would affect the proceedings that we are here on today. The Cadle Company has caused a sale of some of Mike Schultz's assets on January 1, and there was collected about $17,000 towards the judgment. There are additional judgment collection proceedings underway, but none affect what we are here on today. I will focus crisply on the three mandamus issues, then quickly review the procedural history from which the mandamus arises, and then argue the mandamus points. Mike Schultz is under a turnover order and has brought this mandamus petition on three issues. Like many other Texans now who are coming under turnover orders, he needs some clarification and his rights declared. This court has considered four other turnover orders in the last year alone. This one presents these issues. How does one like Mike Schultz, who's been ordered, he's under a turnover order and he complains as to what it is ordering him to do, how does he get it reviewed before it harms him?
Isn't that true of any compulsory order that the trial court issues?
But in this case, Your Honor, the effect of the trial court's order is that just because appeal was perfected and a supersedious bond filed that names a cable company as the beneficiary of that bond, that the trial court is essentially holding back, it's not a final appealable judgment, and there is no suspension of the effect of the order by the supersedious bond. While the appellate court at first denied the leave of cable company to file a motion for contempt, saying that it in essence didn't have jurisdiction, and that's how the trial court has acted. But now it has accepted the jurisdiction. The record's up there. We filed our brief of appellant, and too late to put it on this chart, I've received their reply. And what we have done is we have protected the creditor, fully protected the creditor.
If you are ordered to pay child support and you want to appeal that, if you don't supersede it, you can nevertheless be held in contempt for failing to pay the child support, can't you, even while the issue is on appeal?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And the only way you can challenge that is by habeas corpus, once you are found in contempt and seek that writ.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
But why is it necessary?
This is not child support. And child support has a very specific exception in the rules. Under the Family Code 11.19C, there's an exception on supersedious. In TRAP 47G, there's an exception on supersedious, all relating to family code matters. This is not that.
It's also got an exception in the Constitution under the garnishment prohibition.
Yes, Your Honor.
Child support.
Yes, Your Honor. And this is not a family-related matter. This is an obligation arising on a note. This is an obligation arising on a contract. This is debt. That's what we...
mandamus is proper way to get this matter reviewed by the appellate court as opposed to writ of habeas corpus?
I missed your question.
Why is mandamus proper, in your opinion, as opposed to writ of habeas corpus, apply for writ of habeas corpus?
Because the issue that we are here today on is which of these two courts had jurisdiction to hear the motion for contempt.
You're not challenging the validity of the contempt order of December the 10th, 1990?
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't the proper way to do that by writ of habeas corpus as opposed to mandamus?
We sought leave to supplement the mandamus proceeding with the contempt because we're arguing that there wasn't jurisdiction to even proceed on the contempt.
And my question is, why is mandamus the way to do that as opposed to an application for writ of habeas corpus if you're challenging the validity of the order of contempt?
Because it is ancillary to this dispute between the two courts as to who has jurisdiction, which is already here, and Mike Schultz has not.
not been confirmed yet.
In truth, isn't the aren't these other matters ancillary to the judgment of contempt? I mean, the issue is, you think the contempt order is in effect?
Your Honor, I honestly think that the trial judge feels at this point left out in the cold because he understood the appellate court to be reasoning that it wasn't a final appealable judgment and the supersedious had no defense. Those issues were raised right before him. So having proceeded this way, there is in some senses a waste of court effort here in the trial court. Because of that, it's a judicial inefficiency that the trial court, the appellate court, did not follow the procedure that this court outlined in Ex Parte Boniface, where the trial, the appellate court, retaining jurisdiction, which would indicate the final nature of the judgment that is appealable, that the enforcement is suspended, but nonetheless could refer for evidentiary purposes to the trial court for taking of evidence on the motion for contempt. I have, in that short explanation, basically indicated the procedure by which we arrived here at the Supreme Court. And you are the third column, the appellate court is the middle column, and this is the trial court. And because this is a mandamus proceeding, and we have, in essence, three records, the first, a first supplement, and then a second supplement, I have sought by this chart, for your convenience and your clerk's convenience, to give you the site to where in the record these different orders and these different motions and the like, the record on the contempt, for example, where they are for your convenience, since this is somewhat disorganized on mandamus.
Counsel, I would like to address a particular question that you haven't covered yet. That's the turnover order.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, you know it was amended June 15,
1989. Yes, Your Honor.
It says a court may not enter or enforce order under this section that requires the turnover of proceeds. Okay? And I would like for you to address the sums that we're talking about, $17,250, which I believe were the proceeds of his salary.
No, Your Honor, there was some real estate that was sold, there was some stock that was sold.
Was any of it proceeds of his paycheck?
But not in a traceable fashion, Your Honor.
Okay.
Also those issues are what we are. Our appellate briefing is essentially the Colley v. Colley case that you all have heard. And we are, of course, arguing that the turnover of the paycheck is not permitted. That is what our whole brief in the Court of Appeals is. What we are raising here is which court has the jurisdiction to proceed with an alleged contempt of that. And mind you, the reason for the red band on the supersedious bond is every act, every proceeding, every order of which we complain occurred after Cato became a named beneficiary on supersedious bond issued by State Farm. And it's very important to note, there has never been a contention, a motion filed in the trial court or the appellate court by Cato Company to, in some way, get an order about this supersedious bond. We filed a request that the trial court tell us the amount to set. The trial court did not do so, did not enter an order denying it, but simply didn't set the amount. So we have set the amount, and you're going to hear argument from Cato on they complain about the amount. Your Honors, quickly on the nature of a turnover order as a final appealable judgment, Buhler v. Beaumont Bank, cited in the brief, clearly holds that it's a final order disposing of all issues between all parties. The Dallas Court of Appeals, which at first indicated, as interpreted by the trial court, that it didn't have jurisdiction, has in fact accepted jurisdiction in accordance with Buhler v. Beaumont Bank. I will leave the rest of the argument there in the interest of time.
If that supersedious was proper,
yes, Your Honor.
Then the contempt proceedings were improper.
Yes, Your Honor. The turnover is a final appealable judgment that has been superseded and jurisdiction is in the appellate court. This court has said that in Ex Parte Boniface, which was a habeas corpus proceeding, but it was a judgment to pay monthly retirement benefits to a wife. It relied on Ex Parte Travis. And I would urge you to consider Ex Parte Travis most closely because it's an injunction case, 1934, this court. And that is in essence what turnover is it not? An order to Mike Schultz to reach into his pocket, pull out his paycheck, and hand it to the receiver who's going to pay it to Cato. Injunctive in nature. And this court said in Ex parte Travis that jurisdiction for the enforcement of an injunction is in the appellate court. The appellate court relied on Sullivan v. Sullivan, which, in answer to Justice Heck's questions, or perhaps Cook's questions, indicated it's a child support order, it's the family code, and TRAP provides for that. This case is not just closer to Ex parte Travis. It is actually, because it's ordering only the payment of the money judgment, it is actually a shade closer to just an ordinary judgment, a money judgment, for which it should be final, appealable, supersedious bond, suspend the enforcement of it, and we would be proceeding in an orderly fashion in the appellate court. Finally, Your Honors, I'd like to address the issue of confinement, which was ordered by His Honor Judge Richter in the County Court Law Number 2. The Constitution provides that no person shall ever be imprisoned for debt. And those are very strong words. And in the 1800s, debt in the constitutional frame of law was liability on a contract. The Texas cases clearly, whether they articulate that distinction or whether they are simply proceeding on it without stating it, make that distinction. Child support and things incidental to child support, even attorney's fees, are held to not be debt. In essence,
we don't get to the constitutional question if Judge Richter had no jurisdiction.
That is true, except that because you can see from the very proceedings here that even after they were a named beneficiary, within 11 days they filed a motion for contempt, and the orders of this court will be returning us to the appellate court. And this creditor clearly indicates all intentions to put Mike Schultz in the Trinity River Bottoms in Dallas County, the Lucero Justice Center. He is going to face repeated liability on this.
If your supersedious was effective, though,
that is true.
Then you're...
That is true, Your Honor. There could not be confinement. Your Honors, here we have a character of this obligation as debt arising on a note, an enforcement of a judgment by an Ohio purchaser of judgments in Texas, and confinement here is not a refusal on the part of Mike Schultz to provide information to the court. It is not a refusal on the part of Mike Schultz to answer questions in court. It is not a refusal on the part or conduct of Mike Schultz in court contemptuous of His Honor Judge Richter.
Counsel, your time's up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Mr. Jones will present argument for his final.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Jones. I'm here on behalf of the real party in interest, the Cato Company. It's our position that the only issue that is properly before this court is the issue of whether or not the Court of Appeals has jurisdiction to enforce the turnover order as opposed to the trial court. The only relief that was sought by Mr. Schultz in his motion, which he filed with the Court of Appeals for a writ of mandamus, was to ask the Court of Appeals to hear or to allow the Cato Company to file its motion for contempt in the Court of Appeals and to mandamus the trial court not to proceed further. We believe that the issues concerning imprisonment, concerning an exemption, concerning current wages, whether or not that can be turned over, have been briefed and are before the Court of Appeals and are not before the court today on this petition for a writ of mandamus.
Don't we also need to decide whether the supersedious bond was effective to stay or suspend enforcement of the trial court's judgment?
Yes, sir, but it's our position that that issue is something that must first be presented to the Court of Appeals. We tried to present that issue to the Court of Appeals in our motion for contempt, and the Court of Appeals refused to hear it and told us to go to the trial court. We went to the trial court. The trial court ruled that he was not going to stay the proceeding. He ruled that a supersedious bond was not proper and he would not set the amount. Schultz therefore unilaterally picked an amount which we contend does not cover the amount that's required and filed a supersedious bond despite the fact that the trial court said he believed it was improper. We believe that based upon what the Court of Appeals told the Cato Company, we went to the trial court and the trial court ruled on that issue.
The trial court declined to set a supersedious
bond? Yes, sir.
Bond.
And we believe that's in the record. At the hearing, on the turnover order, the trial court refused to stay enforcement of the order and refused to set a supersedious bond.
How much supersedious bond did they file?
Around $50,000 by our calculations. The total amount due on the judgment is $62,000 at the time that the bond was filed.
If this order can be superseded and proper amount set, then the contempt proceedings in the district court were improper.
Yes, sir.
County court law.
Yes, sir. But the only issue before this court, it's our position, is what court has the right to hear the motion for contempt and decide the issue of whether or not the judgment has been superseded. We initially tried to file our motion for contempt with the Dallas Court of Appeals. Chief Justice Enoch and Justice Rowe declined or denied the motion for leave to file and told us to go to the trial court because the trial court retained jurisdiction. We are well aware of the ruling by this court in the bona fide case that was mentioned by Mr. Evans.
So who do you think is right?
Well, I'm stuck with the position that I tried to file in the Court of Appeals because I was following the bona fide case and they told me to go to the trial court.
So you think the Court of Appeals is wrong and should have heard the motion for contempt?
Yes, sir. I do believe that, although I do believe that the Court of Appeals in its Sullivan decision sets forth why it believes the bona fide case should not be applied and why it attempts to narrowly limit the bona fide case to the issues in that case.
So if you think the Court of Appeals is wrong, then you agree that the trial court did not have jurisdiction to hear this motion for contempt?
Initially, I did. I'm prepared. I think the Dallas Court of Appeals, based upon three or four decisions that it has issued after the bona fide case, makes a valid argument that while in theory the Court of Appeals has jurisdiction, in practice, when you look at the facts in Sullivan, they say it just doesn't work. It's cumbersome, it's expensive, it takes too much time in referring or following the motion for contempt back to the district court for a hearing, an evidentiary hearing, referring the statement of facts back to the Court of Appeals. In the Sullivan case, that went back and forth, I think, a couple of times until the Dallas Court of Appeals finally said, this can't be, the law can't be this awkward and this can't be what was intended by the bona fide case, that we continue to have to refer a case back and forth to the trial court for hearing, basically said, this can't be the way it is. This is too time-consuming. It's too cumbersome. We're going to narrowly limit the bona fide case and rule that it's an exception to the general rule that the trial court retains jurisdiction to enforce its order, and that's what the Dallas Court of Appeals has done in three or four cases. So I believe the Dallas Court of Appeals, their position is that the trial court retains jurisdiction, that while in theory, the Court of Appeals may have jurisdiction. It just doesn't work in common practice, and I do believe from a litigant standpoint that's true. My client would have been required, we did file the motion in the Court of Appeals, it would have been referred back to Judge Richter for a hearing. My client would have had to pay for a statement of facts that we then send back to the Court of Appeals. If there are objections, as there were in Sullivan, or problems with the statement of facts, the Court of Appeals then has to turn around and refer it back to the judge for another hearing, another statement of facts that then gets referred back to the Court of Appeals for additional consideration. And I think that is what the Dallas Court of Appeals in its Sullivan case finally said, this just can't be the way it's supposed to work. We're going to say that the trial court has jurisdiction to hear these matters, and that's why in the three cases that they've heard, or the three reported decisions that they've heard since bona fide, they have continually denied, as they did in this case, the right of the litigant to even file the motion in the Court of Appeals and have basically said the trial court retains jurisdiction.
You think what they should have done is refer the matter back to the take jurisdiction of the motion for contempt, send it back to the trial court solely for the purpose of taking testimony and making factual findings and then sending it back up to the Court of Appeals?
Based upon the bona fide decision, I believe that's correct. But I think that the Court of Appeals is correct that that's a cumbersome procedure and that the most practical way is to let the trial court hear it.
Even though the order of the trial court has been superseded?
Well, that's one issue that hadn't been decided. And that's one issue, well, at least that's one issue that has not been decided by the Court of Appeals. The trial court decided that it has not been superseded. So
I don't understand why the procedure is cumbersome. If the district judge is going to have to entertain proceedings no matter what, why is requiring the Court of Appeals to review the outcome of the proceedings cumbersome?
Well, I believe what the Dallas Court of Appeals is saying, and I agree with them, that it's difficult to refer it back to the district court to have it set for a hearing that takes a certain amount of time to take the evidence, to have a statement of facts prepared, send it back to the Court of Appeals for their review.
Stop there. But before they send it back, all of that that proceeded before you send it back to the Court of Appeals, all that has to be done anyway.
Yes, sir.
So all your, the only cumbersome part of it is sending it back to the Court of Appeals. Why is that cumbersome?
The cumbersome part, I guess what I was trying to say is it's more expensive and it's more time consuming. And I also believe it's important for whoever the trier of fact is to be able to see the witnesses, to be able to hear the evidence, to be able to look at the demeanor and the character. In this case, Dr. Schultz, the trial court ruled, intentionally and willfully violated this order. And I think it's important, this is a little bit different reason, for the trial court to be able to see those witnesses testify and decide what he's going to do, which the Court of Appeals can't do from a cold statement of fact.
Well, there's no question that the trial judge has to take that evidence and make those findings in the first instance, but shouldn't the Court of Appeals have jurisdiction to review it?
They should have jurisdiction to review it, yes, sir.
But they haven't done that in this case. They have not finally ruled whether this can be superseded or not.
No, sir, they didn't. I think, though, that Schultz has the opportunity, if the trial court rules it has not been superseded, I think he has the right to go to the Court of Appeals for a review of that decision, which they have not done. They simply filed the petition for writ of mandamus asking that the Court of Appeals hear the motion and tell the trial court not to, which the Court of Appeals denied. And that's the same relief that they're requesting here, or that they were requesting here until they filed their supplemental petition. Now they want to basically leapfrog over the Court of Appeals and get in front of this court on the issues of turnover and imprisonment for debt, the supersedious issue, which the Court of Appeals hadn't ruled on.
If they asked the Court of Appeals to rule on it and the Court of Appeals denied the motion, where else can they turn?
Well, when the Court of Appeals denied the motion, the Court of Appeals said go to the trial court. The trial court should decide that, but I think the Court of Appeals still has the right to review the determination that's made by the trial court.
When?
When
are they going to do it?
After the trial court makes its determination.
It's made its determination, right?
Yes, sir.
When does the Court of Appeals say yes or no about that?
Well,
in the meantime, after the Court of Appeals, after the district judge, trial court made its decision, it also then entertained contempt proceedings and has made a ruling on that.
But since the time the trial court made its determination, nothing further has been presented to the Court of Appeals. I believe the Court of Appeals would hear it once the trial court has decided. They sent it back for determination, and I think the Court of Appeals, at least I believe, would be willing to look at that determination and decide whether or not the Court of Appeals is going to do something with it.
Counsel, let me back up a minute and make sure I've got this thing in proper context. Your client holds a money judgment.
Yes, sir.
Against the relator here.
Yes, sir.
It's just like any other money judgment for debt.
Yes, sir.
And how have you tried to enforce that money judgment? Have you had execution issued?
Yes,
served?
Sir. We've had execution issued, and I think
What happened on the execution?
Part of it was returned, and if I can explain just a bit, the part of the problem with determining these issues before this court today is that there's a very complicated evidentiary circumstances here. Dr. Schultz is a wealthy physician in Brownwood, Texas. He receives income of $23,000 a month. He got notice from my client that they wanted him to pay this judgment. He immediately embarked upon a series of asset transfers, transferred all his personal property into limited partnerships. When they say that his wages have been garnished, what he has done is had a professional association that he's a shareholder for transfer $23,000 a month into a limited partnership. He then writes checks off of the partnership account for personal expenses. So the facts here are pretty complicated. Dr. Schultz has the ability to pay this. The execution, the sheriff said, well, he's transferred all his property. He's executed contracts for sale, so it was complicated. We did finally have a sheriff's sale. The first of January, that took about 9 months to convince the sheriff, based upon what Mr. Schultz had done with all his property, that there was still something there that perhaps could be sold.
All right, so you got a money judgment, you get rid of execution issue, and you go out and you try and execute on your judgment. So in order to enforce that now, you've had this fellow put in jail.
No, sir, we haven't had him put in jail. We tried, but he hasn't. So far, he hasn't been put in jail. This court stayed the order of commitment.
Well, but,
that's what we're trying to do. Yes, sir, that's correct. We're trying to get this man...
Why is that not enforcement by imprisonment for a debt?
It's our position that this man has the money, and he has the ability. And it's... Our position is if this man
the
had...
The Constitution of Texas say that you can be imprisoned for debt if you got money?
No, sir, but I don't...
But you can't be if you don't?
No, sir, but I do believe it says you can be held in contempt of court for not doing something that a court tells you to, and I realize that may not be a big distinction, but if Mr. Schultz had $100,000 in gold in a savings account, or excuse me, in a safety box, and the court said, I want you to take that money and give it to the sheriff so he can execute on it because he can't get to it otherwise, Mr. Schultz says, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to pay this judgment. I don't have to do what you tell me to. I think a court could hold him in contempt for not doing what the court told him to, but they're going to argue you're putting him in prison for debt because he doesn't want to pay the judgment.
And Counsel, I'm not particularly concerned about your client, Dr. Schultz. I'm concerned about the Constitution.
Yes, sir.
Where it says you cannot imprison a person for non-payment of debt.
Yes, sir.
And why does this not amount to just exactly that you're trying to do?
I believe that the Constitution, when it says that, was designed to prevent a man who makes $18,000 a year and has two kids that he's trying to support, and he can't go to his employer and say, don't pay him any more wages, pay it directly to us. And I don't believe the situation reaches that level. Dr. Schultz has money in a checking account.
Does the guardianship provision cover that, Counsel?
Yes, sir. The difference here is Mr. Schultz has money in an account that he is spending that the court has said, I want you to turn over half of that to pay this judgment.
And you don't think the Constitution ought to apply to him?
I don't.
Because in 1876, we didn't have those kind of banking procedures available.
I think for several reasons, and I think the record before the trial court does not support a holding that these are his wages based upon what he has done with the money. I think we have a very good argument of waiver, and I think the trial court considered that he has waived any exemption he might have by the transfers of the funds in the manner.
He's held that the Constitution of Texas has been waived.
I think an
by this litigant?
I think an exemption can be waived, yes, sir.
You think the Constitution can be waived?
I'm not saying the Constitution. I think an exemption guarantee can be waived by anyone. If Dr. Schultz never attempted to assert that these were his wages, I think he would have waived that argument.
Constitution doesn't say you can't just imprison a man for debt on his wages. You're talking about the garnishment statute now. Garnishment section of the Constitution. I'm talking about the enforcement for debt by imprisonment section of the Constitution.
Okay. No, sir, I agree that can't be waived.
Counsel, isn't it true that on numerous occasions the courts have interpreted the word debt in such a fashion they would allow a creditor to recover?
I'm sorry, I've looked at that, Your Honor. I can't answer that question.
Does a court not have the right to enforce by contempt the enforcement of its lawful orders?
Yes, sir, I believe it does.
If a court cannot enforce by contempt, does it have any power at all?
No, it doesn't. Then you have an individual like Mr. Schultz saying, I'm not going to do what the court told me to because you can't imprison me for debt. We believe the issue before this court is the Sullivan case that for whatever reason, the Dallas Court of Appeals has said they're going to rule that the trial court has jurisdiction, which I believe is in conflict with the bona fide decision. We do believe, though, that the Dallas Court of Appeals had legitimate reasons. And I've sat through the first two arguments today, and I noticed that Bob Bledsoe indicated that the Alfred versus Crum was tough to live with, and I think that's what the Dallas Court of Appeals is trying to say with the bona fide decision and the procedure set forth.
Are you familiar with the Dixon case, which is at 2 Texas 483, which distinguishes between ability to pay and refusal to pay?
Yes, sir.
Is there any question as to inability to pay in this case?
Not at all.
Is it simply a matter of refusal to pay?
Yes, sir.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, in quick rebuttal, I'd like to point out, first of all, if you want to see what the trial court had to say about the supersedious, it did not order that Mike Schultz could not file a supersedious. It did not set the amount. And if you would look at the second motion to supplement the record, the transcript of the hearing on the motion on November 28 is there, and that is discussed for your convenience. As regards
you, the trial court did not expressly deny.
That's right, Your Honor. Nor have they said any relief, sought any relief in the two courts that have jurisdiction over the amount of the supersedious, the appellate or the trial.
Well, and shouldn't some court besides this one decide in the first instance whether or not your client is entitled to supersedious?
Yes, Your Honor.
Either the district court or the court of appeal. And for one reason or another, neither one has decided that issue.
I would suggest yes, but the orders of the trial court are tantamount to deciding that the supersedious has no effect.
Well, I don't mean tantamount. Shouldn't the trial court or the court of appeals say in express terms, one way or the other, yes, you can supersede, or no, you can't?
Yes, Your Honor. And I would like to point out that it was Cable who went to the appellate court. When they came back down to the trial court because the appellate court had ordered that, we filed a motion to quash and put the issue before His Honor, the director, who was very solid and good. He reviewed it and said he wasn't going to overturn the Court of Appeals because they're the ones that reviewed him. We took that to the appellate court before we came here. We sought review of that. We can't get the Dallas Court of Appeals to look at this activity in the shadow of the appeal, and that is the major relief that we're seeking in front of Your Honors here.
Your opponent says that the Court of Appeals had not been asked to rule on the right to supersedious after the remand of the district court.
Yes, Your Honor. My response is that issue is subsumed in whether the judgment is a final judgment. And the trial court is interpreting it as not being a final judgment. And now that they have, after all of this has occurred, this court took petition for mandamus at this point, and then the appellate court starts accepting the record in a timely fashion and the briefing and whatever, the trial court is now out in the cold because he operated under the understanding that they were saying that they didn't have jurisdiction in the first place. And that's why the procedure of having these motions for contempt in trial courts is extremely inefficient because of these very fundamental issues unresolved as between two courts of, I suppose, based on this order, competing jurisdiction. In one sense, neither really wants jurisdiction on this. So, my time is up. Any more questions? Thank you, Your Honor.
This concludes the business of the court. The three cases heard this morning are submitted on the briefs and oral argument. The marshal will adjourn the court.
Robinson, please rise. Oh, yeah. Now, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.